You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah.
This is WBCR LP 97.7 on your FM dial, broadcasting from downtown Great Barrington in the Berkshire Hills of Western Massachusetts. That was The Doors. And this is Mickey Friedman. And this is The Other Side. There are, of course, many sides and many truths. This show is about some of the other sides of the story. My pick of the many stories out there. Most of us hear about the war in dribs and drabs. A 30-second soundbite here, a news item there. I met several women the other day with a son, a nephew, and a future husband, either fighting or about to go. For those who have a loved one over in Iraq, it's a different story. It's a 24-hour-a-day war. That got me thinking about what it would be like to really listen to the war news. So here are bits and pieces of what I call 4 weeks of war. If you have young children about the house, you might want to flip the dial.
In the war on terror, the Marines are serving with valor and distinction. You helped liberate 50 million people in Afghanistan and Iraq. Today you stand between the American people and the worst dangers in the world. In this war, the Marines will fight in the words of the Rifleman's Creed, until victory is America's and there is no enemy. America's grateful to have the United States Marine Corps defending our freedom. I want to thank you for your courage and your sacrifice. Americans know what it's like to be attacked on our own soil. In the face of such adversaries, there is only one course of action. We will continue to take the fight to the enemy, and we will fight until this enemy is defeated. They believe that the world's democracies are weak, and that by killing innocent civilians, they can break our will. They're mistaken. America will not retreat in the face of terrorists and murderers. And we're staying on the offensive. We're fighting the enemy in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and across the world so we do not have to face them here at home. And we are spreading the hope of freedom across the broader Middle East by offering an alternative to the terrorist dark vision of hatred and fear. We are laying the foundation of peace for our children and our grandchildren.
In Iraq, relatives are struggling to identify dozens of charred bodies after a fiery suicide attack that killed more than 90 people south of Baghdad, even as new suicide strikes killed more than 20 others. Police say a suicide bomber blew himself up in front of a Shiite mosque in Musayab late Saturday, triggering a huge explosion as Shiite worshippers headed to sunset prayers. The streets were also full of families out for an evening stroll. Four suicide car bombers struck security patrols and election workers in Baghdad Sunday. Two policemen and a civilian were killed in a suicide attack in eastern Baghdad. The U.S. military says the police were inspecting the bodies of two Iraqis killed by insurgents that had been left in the road as a trap. About an hour later, a second suicide car bomber blew up near a bus station in southern Baghdad, killing three police commandos and four civilians. Five employees of Iraq's Electoral Commission and a policeman were killed in a third bombing outside the offices of Iraq's Electoral Commission. Another suicide car bomber missed a U.S. convoy but struck two minibuses, killing six civilians in Mahmoudiya, south of Baghdad. Insurgent attacks have increased in recent days after a lull following last month's security sweep in Baghdad. Lori Neff, Associated Press.
CNN Radio News. I'm Harry Beadle. A CNN USA Today Gallup poll finds President Bush's approval rating rose a bit during following last week's terrorist bombings in London. But CNN polling director Keating Holland says Americans apparently still have doubts about the way Mr. Bush is fighting the war on terror.
In June, 39% of Americans said the war with Iraq had made the country less safe from terrorism. That number jumped up to 54% in the current poll.
44% also said neither side is winning the war on terror.
Three British soldiers in the southern Iraqi city of Amara are among the dead following more attacks across Iraq Saturday. Six police officers were also killed in the northern city of Mosul, and four other people, including two children, were killed in southern Baghdad. 11 Task Force Baghdad soldiers are being charged in connection with alleged assaults on suspected insurgents. The soldiers are accused of violating the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
It said the charges were filed this week after another soldier complained about the alleged assaults. The military said none of the detainees required medical treatment, with only one still in coalition custody. The soldiers have been taken off duty pending an investigation with the Army to determine whether they should face a court-martial. Also Saturday, suicide attackers killed at least 9 Iraqi forces in separate attacks in Baghdad and outside Mosul, north of the capital. Insurgents kept up their campaign against the country's U.S.-trained security force a day after suicide car bombs and explosions rocked Baghdad. That wave of attacks targeting U.S. and Iraqi forces killed at least 33 people and wounded at least 111, including 7 American soldiers. Ray Bassett, The Associated Press.
13 people have been killed in an ambush of a minibus in the Iraqi city of Bakuba to the north of Baghdad. The bus was carrying 10 workers to an American airbase when gunmen blocked the road with cars and opened fire. From Baghdad, Richard Galpin reports.
The gunmen in two vehicles opened fire on a minibus and a car carrying the workers on a road close to Bakuba. 10 were shot dead. The bus driver, who was injured, lost control of his vehicle and crashed into another car. All those inside were killed. Officials at local hospitals say they're treating more than 20 people injured in the ambush, including a 13-year-old boy. Insurgents have frequently targeted local people contracted to work with American and other coalition forces.
You're listening to the news from the BBC.
In Iraq, relatives are struggling to identify dozens of charred bodies after a fiery suicide attack that killed more than 90 people south of Baghdad, even as new suicide strikes killed more than 20 others. Police say a suicide bomber blew himself up in front of a Shiite mosque in Musayab late Saturday, triggering a huge explosion as Shiite worshippers headed to sunset prayers. The streets were also full of families out for an evening stroll. Four suicide car bombers struck security patrols and election workers in Baghdad Sunday. Two policemen and a civilian were killed in a suicide attack in eastern Baghdad. The U.S. military says the police were inspecting the bodies of two Iraqis killed by insurgents that had been left in the road as a trap. About an hour later, a second suicide car bomber blew up near a bus station in southern Baghdad, killing three police commandos and four civilians. Five employees of Iraq's Electoral Commission and a policeman were killed in a third bombing outside the offices of Iraq's Electoral Commission. Another suicide car bomber missed a U.S. convoy but struck two minibuses, killing six civilians in Mahmoudiya, south of Baghdad. Insurgent attacks have increased in recent days after a lull following last month's security sweep in Baghdad. Laurie Neff, Associated Press.
Meanwhile, a funeral procession was held for eight of the people killed in Saturday's bomb attack in Musayib, in which a suicide bombing ignited a fuel truck in front of a Shiite mosque. The Iraqi government reported on Sunday that the death toll stood at more than 90, and hospital officials said more than 150 people were injured. That attack was the deadliest insurgent strike since the new government was announced on April 28, and exceeded only by a February 28 suicide car bombing in Hilla that killed 125 people. Luke Sheridan, The Associated Press.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Claire Balderson with NewsHour. Violence in Iraq is escalating. There were 17 reported suicide attacks over the weekend. Today, gunmen have ambushed a group of local men travelling to work at an American military base near Bakuba. And in the past few minutes, there have been reports that three members of Iraq's Constitutional Committee have been killed. All are said to be Sunni Muslims. Details are still coming in. But it's difficult to say how many civilians have been killed overall since the US-led invasion in March 2003. Officially, the US and its allies keep no figures, but an independent group of British and American researchers has been trying to collate the figures and has today published its Iraq body count. It concludes that nearly 25,000 civilians have been killed since the invasion. The lead author is John Sloboda. What were the sources for his report?
We've been scouring the world's press and media since the war started, and when two reputable sources cover the same incident and give roughly the same kind of details, then we will add that to our database. So we are building on 10,000 press and media reports from around the world. This is pretty accurate because we have a very high standard for the kinds of agency we will include. I mean, agencies like the Associated Press or Reuters or indeed the BBC.
Who is being killed? Who are the main targets?
The main identifiable targets since about a year ago have actually been the Iraqi police. In terms of occupational groupings, they are the single greatest category of target.
By all accounts, what we hear every day from Iraq, that's getting worse. They're getting more and more targeted. Is that what you found in your statistics?
Yes, our data has shown really an almost inexorable month-on-month rise in killings perpetrated by what you might call the non-coalition side since May 2003, and it just goes up and up month by month.
And yet there's also an interesting statistic you have here where you break down who is carrying out the killings, and what you say is that criminals killed 36% of all civilians. And I find that rather surprising, because unless you call the insurgents criminals, but you're not referring to those kind of people.
No, these are not political killings. There is a lot of random crime in Iraq, and bodies are found on the street, their identities are not known, and they're taken to morgues around the country. And these are statistics from national morgues.
When you say crime, is this, what kind of crime? Is it robberies, revenge,
yeah.
What kind
muggings,
of thing?
Muggings, revenge killings, rapes, almost anything. Crime actually has stayed pretty constant since about May 2003. It's the killings by deliberate targeted anti-occupation forces which have been rising, and that's what contributes to the overall rise.
Why do you do this? Why do you compile these figures?
Because noting and honouring the innocent dead is a primary responsibility of civilisation, and it's not being done by anybody else. And so really we are proving to the world that it can be done with limited resources, and in a sense it's a challenge to officials and governments to say, why aren't you doing it?
One of the other things you look at also is the wounded, and that number seems to be extremely high.
For every one civilian that's killed, three civilians are wounded.
What happens to those people?
We actually don't know, because the reporters, by and large, come on the scene in the hours after an incident, and people who are injured may die later, and we never hear about that.
Professor John Sloboda of the Iraq Body Count.
The family of an Iraqi civilian who died at a British military base is demanding justice after the British government confirmed that war crimes charges have been filed against three British soldiers for the inhumane treatment of detainees in Iraq. In Basra Tuesday, Hussein Baha, the son of Baha Musa, said he wants the British soldiers who killed his father put on trial. In London, their attorney demanded that the charges be heard in a civilian court rather than in a court-martial.
Baha Musa was murdered. He died in pain, in terror, with a hood over his head, having been beaten mercilessly for 3 days. If that's not murder, I don't know what is.
Tuesday, British officials said the three soldiers will face a court-martial for the abuse of Iraqi detainees, including Musa, a 26-year-old hotel receptionist who died in British military custody after he was arrested in September 2003. The most serious charges were brought against a 34-year-old corporal who was accused of manslaughter in Musa's death and of urging others not to tell the truth about the incident. Laurie Neff, Associated Press.
Thank you.
A funeral in Baghdad Wednesday for two Sunni Muslims involved in drafting Iraq's constitution. The two, along with a bodyguard, were gunned down on a busy Baghdad street Tuesday. One of the victims was among 15 Sunni Arabs appointed to the committee writing the constitution. To give Sunnis a greater voice in preparing the document, which has to be approved by Parliament by August 15th. Other Sunnis Wednesday suspended their membership to the panel, citing security concerns. Two other Sunnis had already quit because of insurgent threats. Also in Baghdad Wednesday, a suicide bomber blew himself up outside an army recruiting center, killing at least 10 people and injuring more than 20 others. The center has been targeted multiple times in recent months. Explosions were also reported at two domestic pipelines in central Iraq. Such attacks often mean more electricity shortages in Baghdad. And the government, led by Prime Minister Ibrahim El-Jafari, observed 3 minutes of silence for the nearly 100 victims of a massive suicide bombing in Musayab over the weekend, and for nearly 30 others, mostly children and teens, killed in a Baghdad suicide attack last week. Laurie Neff, Associated Press.
On the political front, terrorists have failed to derail the political process. A constitutional referendum remains on schedule for October 15th, and elections for a new assembly are scheduled for December 15th of this year. And Iraq's confidence in the future is increasing. A recent poll showed that the number of Iraqis believing that their country is going in the right direction has gone up from 52% in January to some 61.5% today. On the economic front, new business registrations have increased by about 50% in the first 6 months of this year. There's been a remarkable growth in cell phone and internet usage. Access to both were severely restricted under Saddam Hussein's repressive regime.
Insurgent attacks in Iraq on Thursday, including two suicide bombings aimed at the Iraqi army, killed at least 15 people. The violence took place amid gunmen abducting two Algerian diplomats and their driver in the capital Baghdad. In Mahmoudia, south of Baghdad, a suicide bomber rammed into an Iraqi army checkpoint, killing six soldiers, wounding 13. Another suicide bomber hit another Iraqi army checkpoint in southern Baghdad, killing one soldier, wounding six. In western Baghdad, gunmen assassinated three members of a provincial council as they were heading to an internet cafe. And in Baghdad's Shiite enclave of Sadr City, a drive-by shooting killed an Iraqi trade ministry employee. Still more attacks beyond the capital killed four, injuring five. Also, the U.S. military said a sailor assigned to a Marine combat team died of wounds from a bombing last week west of Baghdad. Finally, in political developments, Sunni Arabs decided to continue boycotting the committee drafting Iraq's new constitution. They want an international probe into the killings of two of their colleagues this week and a greater role in drafting the charter. Ray Bassett, The Associated Press.
Finally, on the security front, infrastructure attacks have decreased since the January election. Week-to-week incidents are off their pre-election peak. And the number of Iraqi security forces now exceeds the number of coalition troops by a good margin. The report also offers a candid assessment of the challenges that remain for the Iraqi people and for the coalition. Among them, though they've suffered numerous setbacks, terrorists in Iraq remain effective, adaptable, and intent on carrying out attacks against Iraqi civilians and Iraqi officials. Extremists continue to try to foment tension, ethnic strife, and indeed even civil war between Sunnis and Shias, through murder and attacks on religious sites.
A suicide attacker slammed a truck loaded with explosives into concrete barriers outside a Baghdad police station Sunday, killing at least 20 people and wounding 30. Police say a number of cars, including two police cars, caught fire and several nearby shops were damaged. The blast left a giant blackened crater at the scene. Insurgents have regularly targeted Iraqi police and security forces in attempts to further destabilize the country, which has been struggling to put together a new constitution and broad-based government. Members of former Prime Minister Iyad Alawi's bloc Sunday threatened to walk out of the Constitutional Drafting Committee in support of a Sunni group that boycotted the process. The mixed makeup of the committee was deemed crucial for drafting a constitution acceptable to all of Iraq's ethnic and religious communities, a key to any political exit from the unremitting violence and the need for American troops to remain in Iraq. Laurie Neff, Associated Press. Hospital and police officials in Iraq say more than 10 people were killed Monday in a suicide minibus attack outside a Baghdad hotel once used by American contractors. At least 18 others were injured. The death toll from Sunday's truck bomb attack outside a Baghdad police station rose to at least 39, as many who survived the initial blast died from burns in the hospital overnight. Amid the continuing violence, Sunni Arab members of a committee drafting Iraq's new constitution ended their boycott Monday. They walked out last week to protest the assassinations of two fellow Sunnis who were working to frame the constitution. Their return lifted the threat that the constitution would be drafted by only two of Iraq's three major ethnic and religious groups, leaving out the Sunnis who form the core of the insurgency. Lori Neff, Associated Press.
As relentless insurgent violence continues to shake Iraq, the country's fledgling security forces are still struggling to stop them. In a progress report to Congress this past week, the Pentagon conceded that few Iraqi forces are capable of battling insurgents on their own. NPR's Eric Westerveld reports.
Earlier this summer, on a windswept U.S. military base in eastern Baghdad, Sergeant First Class Chris Catalano oversaw what you might call combat driver's ed, Iraqi style.
Hey, Blade.
Yeah?
Tell him we're going to do this real slow and easy. Okay, wait a minute. Switch on, start, switch off.
The old British-made Spartan armored personnel carrier turns awkwardly on a football field-sized patch of concrete. Catalano, a 39-year-old reservist from New Jersey, clings precariously to the vehicle's front end, barking instructions into the driver's hatch.
We do what we call the crawl, walk, run. Right now we're in the crawl phase.
The driver moves the steering stick in jerky motions as the engine spits black smoke. Fresh paint can't conceal the shoddy shape of these old reconnaissance vehicles. Jordan donated 36 of them to Iraq, only a handful even work. But they offer the promise of far more protection than what Iraqis currently take into combat, beat-up old Nissan pickup trucks. Sergeant Catalano.
So this will definitely give them a better ability, boost their confidence. They'll be able to get soldiers into a combat situation a lot safer.
Steering skills aside, Catalano says this unit of what's called the Iraqi Intervention Force is competent and battle-tested in Fallujah, Mosul, and Baghdad. But they're still not ready to fight on their own, says Army Lieutenant Colonel Marcus de Oliveira. He's lived and trained with the intervention force for months as their U.S. liaison. They've made big strides, de Oliveira says, but the Americans still help with nearly every major detail of combat operations.
The remaining military support structures are not in place in the country. Intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance support to tactical units and Iraqi logistical systems are not in place. It will take some time until that's in place.
American investigators say they've found serious problems with Iraq's U.S.-trained police force. Their report says many police recruits are marginally literate, many have criminal records, and some are working with the enemy. Here's NPR's Eric Westerveld.
The report's criticisms are blunt. Faulty and inadequate vetting has resulted in too many recruits with criminal records, literacy problems, and physical handicaps. Even more troubling, the report says, is, quote, infiltration by intending terrorists or insurgents. There is sufficient evidence to conclude that such persons indeed are among the ranks of the Iraqi police service, end quote. Iraqi police stations and car patrols are daily targets of insurgent attacks, including a deadly attack on a police garrison in Baghdad on Monday. Officials in the State and Defense Department's Inspector General Office declined to talk about the new report on tape, saying it speaks for itself. The report says an emphasis on the number of recruits, a goal of 135,000 by the end of next year, has overshadowed attention to the quality of those trained. The authors note numerous anecdotal accounts of serious breakdowns in police discipline, petty corruption, feuds among police units, ghost employees who don't show up for work, and abuse of prisoners in police custody.
An Iraqi newspaper has published a draft of the new constitution that will be presented to the National Assembly, allowing ordinary Iraqis to see the document. In Baghdad, this resident said the constitution should equally represent all Iraqis. But a chapter of the draft obtained by the Associated Press gives Islam a major role in Iraqi civil law, raising concerns that women could lose rights in marriage, divorce, and inheritance. Shiite Muslim leaders have pushed for a stronger role for Islam in civil law, but women's groups argue that could base legal interpretations on stricter religious lines that are less favorable toward women.
The senior American military commander in Iraq, General George Casey, said this week that he believes the United States could begin to draw down U.S. forces by the spring of 2006 if progress continues.
If the political process continues to go positively, and if the development of the security forces continues to go as it is going, I do believe we'll still be able to take some fairly substantial reductions in the spring and summer next year.
Progress in Iraq is a very big if on both the security and political fronts. By all accounts, insurgent violence has remained steady and in some cases escalated over the past year. NPR's Eric Westervelt has this update on what's known about the makeup and political goals of Iraq's insurgents.
In late May, amid a fresh wave of devastating suicide car bombings, Iraq's ministers of interior and defense stood side by side. It was get tough time, they said. They announced that a big new crackdown was coming to Baghdad. 40,000 Iraqi security forces would set up hundreds of checkpoints and crush the insurgents. Defense Minister Sadun al-Dulaimi.
We will establish, with God's help, an impenetrable blockade surrounding Baghdad like a bracelet surrounds a wrist.
In fact, insurgents broke through the impenetrable blockade almost immediately. Insurgents quickly targeted the very checkpoints set up to stop them. A few days later, a new wave of suicide and car bomb attacks shook Iraq, including a bombing in the predominantly Shiite city of Hilla, south of Baghdad. That killed 31 and wounded more than 100. The bloodbath persists into the summer. Attacks on U.S. and Iraqi forces continue as well. In all, military officials say there are between 60 and 70 a day, the majority spread across four predominantly Sunni provinces. U.S. and Iraqi forces have captured or killed tens of thousands of insurgents and suspects in the last 2 years, yet the many branches of the insurgency seem to remain resilient, adaptable, and formidable. U.S. officials still believe the majority of the insurgents are Sunnis and former Ba'athists from Saddam's special security forces. But several U.S. military officials and analysts interviewed believe that these trained paramilitary forces have been joined in significant numbers over the last year by disaffected Sunnis who were on the fence but now strongly oppose any U.S. presence.
I think it'd be a mistake to suggest that this insurgency has the support of the people or that's popular. I mean, there's no Ho Chi Minh. There's no Mao Zedong. What you've got is a bunch of people, a lot of them foreigners, in there killing Iraqis. They're now killing not just Shia, but they're killing Sunnis. And they're angering people in that country because they realize that it's mindless carnage.
President Bush has said repeatedly that taking on these foreign fighters is a key reason to continue the U.S. military operation in Iraq.
And we fight today because terrorists want to attack our country and kill our citizens. And Iraq is where they're making their stand.
The president often calls Iraq the central front in the war on terrorism. But new studies of radical jihadists captured en route to Iraq show that the U.S. invasion made Iraq a central front. A Saudi Arabian researcher interviewed 300 Saudi nationals caught coming into Iraq. The researcher had full cooperation from Saudi intelligence. He found that the vast majority were motivated by imams and internet activists calling for the expulsion of American infidel occupiers from Arab soil. The researcher found that these young middle and upper middle class Saudis were radicalized by the U.S. invasion. The majority had not been involved at all in terrorism before they left for Iraq.
Two people were killed and 20 injured when mortar rounds landed on Baghdad's main bus station. South of Baghdad, insurgents fired mortars on an Iraqi military base there, injuring another 10 people. The U.S. command also announced that four American soldiers from Georgia's 48th Infantry Brigade were killed by a roadside bomb on Sunday night. Joe Persek, The Associated Press.
Come down off your throne and leave your body alone. Somebody has to change. You are the reason I've been waiting so long. Somebody holds the key.
in southern Iraq on Saturday. A roadside bomb killed two British contractors guarding a British diplomatic convoy on the outskirts of Basra. An Iraqi police captain said two Iraqi children were seriously wounded when a second device exploded minutes after the convoy was targeted. Most of Britain's troops in Iraq are deployed in the country's south. Basra is home to their headquarters and a British consulate general's office. In violence elsewhere on Saturday, a car bomb exploded near the National Theater in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. Police and witnesses said that blast killed seven, including three policemen. And they said another 25 were wounded, including three more policemen, a mother, and her young children. The children did not appear seriously hurt. Also, a prominent Sunni Arab leader said gunmen in military garb tried to assassinate him near an Iraqi army checkpoint, wounding his bodyguard. Sunni leaders have accused Iraq's Shiite-led government of sanctioning attacks by Shiite military forces against the Sunni community. Finally, members of the committee writing Iraq's new constitution said major differences remain only 2 weeks before the deadline for parliament to approve the draft. Ray Bassett, The Associated Press.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Seven U.S. Marines died yesterday in fighting in Iraq. They were killed in Anbar province in the west of the country. More than 1,800 U.S. troops have died since the invasion in March of 2003. We're joined from Baghdad by NPR's Philip Reeves. And Philip, what more have you learned about what happened to these Marines who were killed?
Well, the U.S. military says that the Marines were out on foot conducting operations outside Haditha. Five of them were killed by small arms fire. Now, that's a term that usually refers to Kalashnikovs and rocket-propelled grenades. One of them was unaccounted for, and his body was later found a few kilometers away and safely recovered. Now, a seventh Marine was killed by a suicide car bomb whilst conducting combat operations elsewhere in a place called Heat, and statements appeared on the internet purporting to be from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, claiming responsibility for that killing.
So six of these Marines killed were in this town of Haditha. This has been a trouble spot, is that right, in the Sunni triangle for some time?
Yes, it has. It's one of the areas where the Sunni-led insurgency has been at its most persistent. In fact, only last week, two American Marines from the same combat team as the six who died yesterday were attacked and killed, and that was part of a firefight in the same area near Haditha, in a village near Haditha, in which there was an airstrike eventually, and the U.S. military said it killed nine insurgents.
Good afternoon. I'm Catherine Nero in for Tanya O'Rourke, and we are continuing to follow developing news on the deaths of five local Marines in Iraq. David Kruder of Miami Township in Hamilton County is the latest casualty. He died when a roadside bomb exploded. Also killed, 22-year-old Lance Corporal Timothy Bell of Westchester, 25-year-old Lance Corporal Michael Cifuentes of Oxford, 19-year-old Lance Corporal Chris Dyer of Evendale, and 23-year-old Brett Whiteman of Sabina in Clinton County. Nine News reporter Tom McKee begins our live team coverage. We spoke to the Kruder family just a few minutes ago. Tom?
Well, Catherine, David Kruder's mother, Pat, told me that yesterday morning she had a gut feeling that her son was among the victims of this bombing in Iraq. The official word, of course, the official sad word came around 5:30 last night. Now, David Kruder joined the Marines because he wanted to do the toughest thing he could do in life. He was a 1997 graduate of St. Xavier High School and earned a degree in criminal justice from UC in 2004. His Marine Reserve unit was sent overseas in February and arrived in Iraq in March. Kruder was due home in about a month, but he wanted to go to Officer Candidate School to make the Marines a career.
There are a lot of other parents and wives and siblings that have soldiers in Iraq and other places, and they're just as important as our son David, and they mean just as much to other people as our son David, and they're really heroes too. Our son is not a hero, he's just a good guy, and we just love him.
Now, David Kruder had just gotten married to Christina last September. They had a 7-week-old son, Christian. Catherine.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. A Marine battalion based in Ohio is mourning the loss of 14 of their own, killed today by a bomb in Iraq's Anbar province. It's the battalion's second loss in 3 days. On Monday, six other Marines died in the same area.
Scarcely a day passes in Iraq's Sunni triangle without bombings, kidnappings, suicide attacks and assassinations. It's the epicenter of a war that's been going on for more than 2 years. More than 1,800 Americans have lost their lives, and so have many more Iraqis. For the US forces fighting Sunni-led insurgents in and around the run-down, dirt-poor Sunni towns that stretch along the western reaches of the Euphrates River, today was bloodier than most. Army Brigadier General Carter Ham, who's Director of Regional Operations on the Joint Staff, briefly outlined events to a Pentagon press conference.
This morning at about 06:30 local time in Iraq, a mounted U.S. Marine element operating near Haditha was attacked by an explosive device. Initial reports are that 15 personnel were killed in the attack, 14 United States Marines and one interpreter.
The 14 Marines who died today were killed by what the military calls an improvised explosive device, or IED. This term generally refers to roadside bombs, although this one appears to have been particularly powerful. General Ham says the number of IED attacks has been going down, but, he adds,
we are seeing larger amounts of explosives. We are seeing different techniques that are being used in an effort to counter the efforts of coalition and Iraqi security forces to protect folks while they are moving. Different types of penetrators, different techniques of triggering the events.
The 3rd Battalion, 25th Marines, is based in Ohio, in the Cleveland suburb of Brook Park. From member station WCPN, Renita Jablonski reports.
Many of these small bungalow homes in the neighborhood around headquarters and service company 3rd Battalion 25th Marines are decorated with red, white, and blue ribbons. Flags spill from porches, barely moving in the 90-degree heat. Brook Park Mayor Mark Elliott says the community is still in shock.
The first report where the 6 Marines that had lost their lives, that was very, very difficult and shocking to the town. And then when we woke up this morning and saw that there's another report of 14 others, that's just stunning.
About 3.5 hours south of Brook Park, Martins Ferry Police Chief Barry Carpenter says the news still doesn't seem real.
I always thought that based on his demeanor and his attitude, that if anybody was going to come back from Iraq unscathed, it would have been Nate.
Carpenter says he's haunted by his last conversations with Sergeant Nathaniel Rock. The 26-year-old Rock was a Martins Ferry police officer and among the 21 Marines killed in the last 3 days. Carpenter says he talked to Rock several times since he arrived in Iraq at the beginning of March.
He had some young guys in his platoon that he was kind of concerned for because of some of the things they witnessed. He was a little higher maturity level, but he was kind of concerned with some of the things they witnessed that really bothered them. And he always said, you know, it was real tough what they were involved with and, you know, fighting them insurgents. And they were a very active company, and they suffered a high casualty rate.
If your memory serves you well,
shall meet again if your memory serves you well.
First, let me say that, you know, we mourn the loss of every fallen troop. And a community outside of Cleveland, Brook Park, Ohio, suffered mightily over the last couple of days. It's the people of Brook Park and the family members of those who lost their life, I hope they can take comfort in the fact that millions of their fellow citizens pray for them. Hope they also take comfort in the understanding that the sacrifice was made in a noble cause. We're laying the foundation of peace for generations to come. We're defeating the terrorists in a place like Iraq so we don't have to face them here at home. And as well, we're spreading democracy.
This is a time of mourning for some Ohio families and their neighbors. They're preparing to receive the remains of 19 Marines killed in Iraq this week. These reservists were members of a unit based in Brook Park, a suburb of Cleveland. NPR's Cheryl Corley visited one of the families.
It was 5:45 Wednesday morning when Paul Schroeder sat straight up in the bed. He knew something was wrong. Several hours later, Marines would come to his home and tell him and his wife, Rosemary Palmer, that their son was dead.
Is that a parent's sixth sense? Maybe. I just felt it.
Lance Corporal Edward Schroeder was 23 and one of 14 Marines who died in a roadside explosion. Five others from the Ohio unit were killed earlier in the week while on sniper duty. Sitting at their dining room table, Schroeder's parents and his older sister, Amanda, sifted through a handful of his pictures.
Well, that was my graduation, but it was just showing, like, how he, you know, he was always, like, a little bit of a ham.
A young Edward preens in the picture. And another family favorite, there's Edward the preteen, dressed in a tuxedo-like suit with a dummy by his side for his bumbling magician act. Reporters have come to the house all day to talk to the family. Palmer hands out a sheet of paper. It says her son's nickname was Augie. He spent his preschool years in China. He became a certified emergency medical technician in high school. It's a list Palmer prepared before she knew for certain that her son had died.
Because I wanted people to know Augie. The company's getting smaller and smaller because more and more guys have been killed. So it's getting to the point where if you're getting 14 guys, the odds are getting really tight. And so the chances of it being him were pretty high. So I wrote that so that I could have it. I called it his Vita because I didn't want to call it anything else.
When he was little, Palmer says she wouldn't let her son play with guns. She certainly did not want him involved in the military. But Edward Schroeder says his son was a determined young man who followed through when his mind was set, and he liked doing things that were difficult.
The Marines were like that to him. This is difficult. This is something that not everybody does.
Schroeder says his son has always believed in serving his country, whether it was lifeguarding at the local swimming pool, serving as an emergency technician, or going to Iraq. But while the family is clearly proud of Edward Schroeder, his death solidifies their protest against the war. Amanda says her younger brother was her best friend, and she knows his death, along with the others, will have an impact.
Everyone who wants peace in the first place is going to be angry. And then people who, you know, were thinking that this was a good idea might start to think that it's not. I don't know. I mean, I'm a pacifist. I did not support this war, but I obviously supported my brother. I don't think his death is going to change, like, what the administration wants to do, but I think it should.
Tonight we begin with the parents of Lance Corporal Edward Schroeder, who was among the 14 Marines who lost their lives in yesterday's attack in Iraq. His parents, Rosemary Palmer and Paul Schroeder, join me now from their home outside Cleveland. Well, it's a terrible thing to do, but I want to talk to you both about the war in Iraq and the loss of your son. Ms. Palmer, did you sense that this war was very dangerous for your son even before yesterday?
Well, war is always dangerous, and there were so many deaths, you know, that it was starting to mount to a point where I was actually thinking yesterday that if Augie were not among the 14 killed, that I was almost to the point of calling the Department of Defense and just saying, for mental health reasons, he had to come home, that I couldn't handle it anymore. It was just too much.
What made you feel that the danger was growing?
Well, it's the old game of the fewer. And the 325 unit that he's in has been having more and more casualties. And if you have fewer guys and the same number of people, well, then, you know, the chances are growing that your person is going to be the one that's hit.
Let me ask you, Mr. Schroeder, why do you think we're in this war? What do you think is the real reason for this war in Iraq?
Well, I really don't know why. I could guess, which might be unfair, but I would guess it has to do with oil. It has to do with deposing a dictator that we used to love and came to hate.
Yeah.
That goes on repeatedly.
What did your son say was his motivation for fighting? Was it just patriotism to our country or a belief in the mission?
He did not have a motivation to fight. He had a motivation to do his duty to the Marine Corps and to be part of the Marines. His entire life was devoted to doing what he promised he would do.
What did he tell you, Wayne? What did he say about how the war was going?
Well, early on, when his unit arrived there in March, he was talking about the friendly Iraqi people. After May and June, he stopped talking about the friendly people. Not that they weren't friendly, but he stopped talking about it. 2 weeks ago, in the last conversation I had with him, he simply said, the closer we get to coming home, the less worth it this is.
How did you interpret that?
I took that to mean that his participation in Operation Matador, Operation Newmarket, Operation Sword, Operation Spear, and a couple others that I don't know the names of, were failing. And that's basically the operations were intended to go into these towns, kick out the insurgents, take their weapons, arrest whoever they could, and then they would withdraw. They only had to go back and find more insurgents in the same places. The fact that these 14 fellows were blown up indicates to me, logic would say, that this policy, this strategy, this tactic has failed.
Let me go to Rosemary.
If it was successful, then he would still be alive, as would all those other guys.
Rosemary, let me ask you about what is your feelings about this war in the goal of trying to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, and do you think that was a smart thing for us to try to do?
It was a very naive thing for us to do. You don't go to another culture and try to impose yours and expect it to work. You know, we're not Iraqis. You know, we don't have the same culture. And while I understand that we're a multicultural nation, we don't act like it sometimes. We act like the whole world thinks exactly the way we do.
Do you think that the war is going to get any better now that your son, I mean, you paid the ultimate price. And by the way, thank you. I don't know what it means to say thank you for your service, except I mean it. I mean, the courage of these young guys and some women over there is unbelievable. And I guess everybody wonders about the conduct of the war, whether these lives are being wasted or these lives are being put to good purpose. What's your feeling about that now?
Well, I personally believe that since it's not working, then we have to make a change, that it's not worth the sacrifice if it's just more bodies onto the heap. You know, like President Bush said, he wanted to stay the course and honor the memory of the ones who died by continuing to fight. If it didn't work before, why does fighting more, you know, do the same thing over and over? That's the expecting a different result is, I think, the explanation of insanity.
Yeah. Well, the way you describe it is like pouring water into a sand hole on the beach and having it drain right through and start over again. It seems like a repetitive process that doesn't seem to be getting anywhere.
Well,
exactly.
The repetitive process has been going on for 27 months since the active invasion phase ended. 27 months of doing the same thing over and over and over again with no evidence that it's getting better. If there were evidence it was getting better, and I've yet to see it, and I, frankly, if it was getting better, these fellows would still be alive after all of this strenuous effort, then it is time to make a change. Either put the number of troops on the ground that you need to really do the job or get the heck out.
Kill her son! Kill her son!
Led by the mother of a U.S. soldier killed in Iraq,
Some 50 protesters today tried to take their pain and anger to the president at his ranch.
He took something away from me that's irreplaceable. He's going on a five-week vacation when we're in the middle of war, and I'm never going to be able to enjoy another vacation because he killed my oldest son.
The passion of their message reflects the polarizing effects of war, and maybe why some in the administration tried over the last several weeks to call the conflict something else.
I think I've objected to the use of the term war on terrorism before because, one, if you call it a war, then you think of people in uniform as being the solution.
As our country wages the global struggle against the enemies of freedom.
But when the effort to rebrand the war only fueled late-night comics, the president on Wednesday made sure everyone everywhere knew what he was calling it.
Make no mistake about it. We are at war.
And not just once, but more than a dozen times in a 47-minute speech.
We're at war. We're facing an enemy. To win this war on terror, this war is against killers who hide.
Professor James Thurber of American University thinks the name game by the administration shows a struggle to sell a war that's becoming more unpopular.
I think the president at this point wants to get stronger support from the American public. I think he thinks if he says that we're at war, that he'll get more support.
Both the protesters and the president agree that war is the right word. But under the Constitution, only Congress can declare war. And no Congress has asserted that authority since Pearl Harbor. Mark Noller, CBS News, with the president in Crawford, Texas.
In the U.S., the realities of the war are hitting home in many communities far from military bases, as more members of the National Guard are sent to Iraq. In recent days, the Georgia National Guard saw its first combat deaths since World War II. In three road bombings, 11 servicemen died. Joshua Leves visited the family of one of those troops and has this report.
Daphne Kinlow sits on her bed, her arms wrapped around a large cardboard box.
This is my James Kinlow box. It's my time capsule.
It contains newspaper announcements of his death and dozens of cards from people throughout the country.
It's just been overwhelming how they've come out and said, "We appreciate the sacrifice that your husband made, and that I will share with my grandkids one day."
35-year-old James Kinlow and three of his comrades on the 48th Brigade Combat Team were killed when their Humvee was struck by an improvised explosive device during a patrol in Baghdad. Daphne knew something was wrong when she didn't hear from him. She stayed late at work at the McDuffie County School offices near her home in Thompson, Georgia. She thought about what James said would happen if he died. Two military officials would bring her the news.
And I was just standing there, and I happened to look up, and here come two suits down the hall. And I said, "Oh, my God."
They stepped into a room where one read the announcement of James Kinlow's death.
Bless his heart. The chaplain was there and he was steady, but the guy that read it, he just could not get through it. He just sobbed with me.
Major General David Poitras is Georgia's adjutant general. He oversees the state's National Guard. He says losing all these soldiers within days of each other has been a tough blow to the state's military community.
It's painful for everybody involved, certainly most for the families, but also for their extended family in the Guard.
Most of the 9,000 members of the Georgia National Guard have served in Iraq over the past 2 years, but these were the first combat deaths in six decades.
We've had to learn how to hold military funerals.
Poitras said he expects it will be tougher to draw people into the National Guard.
I think it's fair to say that we will see some changes in terms of recruiting and retention. Certainly, recruiting is down. There's no doubt that it's because of the war and the ultimate possibility of death.
In Iraq, insurgents stepping up their attacks on American soldiers.
Yesterday evening, two U.S. soldiers were killed, three others wounded in the town of Samarra, about 110 miles north of Baghdad, when an IED, an explosive device laid in the road, exploded as their convoy was driving past. Samarra was relatively quiet up until this point in the past few weeks, but obviously this is the most recent act of violence.
Correspondent Cal Perry in Baghdad. Into Crete, a suicide bomber blowing up a fuel truck outside a police station, killing two officers.
We're at the local baseball park, where the hometown team is trying to win a championship. This is a place that knows hard times and the high price of war. As the sun sets at Point Stadium,
let's go, Grace! Let's go, Grace!
It seems nearly impossible.
My brother-in-law, Dan Matthews, is in Fallujah.
To pass a person in the park.
His name's Adam Catney.
and he just went to Iraq in May.
Without a loved one or a friend.
My son, he was injured in Iraq.
In Iraq, in Afghanistan, in harm's way.
I get chills all over. And I have a friend right now in Iraq.
We have a joke. I mean, we don't bleed red, we bleed green. We're Army, and we are one big Army family.
Johnstown, PA, an old mill town, where neighbors are nice, wages are low. And hard luck moved in 100 years ago and never left. In 1889, a massive flood killed thousands, nearly destroying Johnstown. In the 1980s, the steel industry went belly up. So today, the prison and the National Guard are two of the biggest employers here.
Our economy around here is not that strong. It hasn't been strong since the 70s.
So it's part patriotism, part paycheck.
I think so, you know, I really do.
So the service is a chance for a young man, young woman to make a good living.
Right, exactly.
Ron and Don Golby's son joined the Army to pay for college. Sergeant Christopher Golby was killed in Iraq last year. His helicopter shot down near Fallujah.
What did Daddy do in the Army?
Fly helicopters.
That's their grandson, Dylan, Sergeant Golby's 6-year-old boy.
What's that around your neck?
Like ashes.
Your father's ashes.
And the Golbys say they know all too well what those reservist families in Philadelphia are now going through.
Knowing that pain and how much it's, God, seeing those Army guys coming up your sidewalk is just, you know. You know before they even hit the door what they're going to tell you.
What to tell her grandson, says Don Golby, is the hardest part. So she started a notebook for Dylan and a letter from a mom to her youngest son.
Dear baby boy, yes, even though you are 26 to me, you'll always be my baby boy forever. I think of you so much and miss you with all my heart. Gosh, Chris, there's times I still wonder, will you call tonight? Will you just walk through the door yelling, hey, Mom, I'm home, get any food? How I wish I could turn back the clock and see you again and hear you say, Mom, one more time.
Mrs. Golby says she finds those letters both helpful and heartbreaking. Like most here, she's going on with life, but Iraq is always on her mind. Always.
You know the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide.
We heard A Day in the Life by Beck, Can't Find My Way Home by Bonnie Raitt, and This Wheel's on Fire by The Band. Previous episodes of The Other Side can be downloaded as MP3 files from the action page of iraqproject.org, iraqproject.org. The Other Side is now available as a podcast. Depending on your podcasting software, you can type in The Other Side at podcast.net or find it in the politics category at the new iTunes podcast section. If you hit subscribe, new programs will automatically be downloaded to your computer for future listening. You can send comments, suggestions, and criticism to Mickey at iraqproject.org. That's Mickey at iraqproject.org. This is WBCRLP, 97.7 FM, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. This is Mickey Friedman, and this is The Other Side.